Yesterday we spoke about Mara, and today I want to talk about Buddha, not the historical person, but what it was that rendered Siddhartha Gautama the Buddha. The Buddha means the awakened one, the awake one, the one who has woken up. And what we call that state is awakening. I prefer this term to the more commonly used term enlightenment. The Buddha described it as an awakening. So what is it that then constitutes that awakening? I hardly need to say that there is a wide variety of opinion on this subject. And different Buddhist teachers, different Buddhist traditions have their own particular understanding of what this means, of what this entails. I'd like to look at this idea on the basis of a couple of passages that we find in the Pali texts, and in other words, to go back as close as we can to some of the descriptions, accounts of this awakening that come from the Buddha himself. The first passage or passages come from a sutta, a discourse called the Noble Quest. You have it in the handout. I'm not going to go through it in any detail today. But this text, which is the 26th middle-length discourse, is, I think, a rather important document, because in it the Buddha describes his own process from leaving home until becoming the Buddha, and then it continues up to the point where he starts teaching. He tells his story. And we have there, in one paragraph, his account of the awakening. And he describes it not as a shattering knowledge of some privileged truth, of some absolute truth, of an unconditioned, but rather he describes it in terms of a fundamental shift in perspective. What he calls a movement from attachment to place to seeing what he calls this ground. And the ground he describes as conditioned arising. We have, again, a much quoted passage in Majjhima 28, where Sariputta cites the Buddha as saying, "One who sees conditioned arising sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees conditioned arising." And this seems to be the founding insight upon which the Buddha's teaching, the Dhamma, is then extrapolated and developed. The Buddha describes his experience as moving from a fixed position, a fixed place, a fixed identity, and we can understand that as the whole attachment we have to our ego identity, being me, and as such being somehow as separate, somehow cut off from other people, the world, having one's prime preoccupation, and again, this would have its roots in our deep instincts for survival, to hold on at all costs to this identity of being an isolate, ego, self, person that doesn't change, that is somehow a unitary. There's no parts, no bits or pieces. There is just this pure identity of me. We can also understand this this place as being one's identity as defined by, let's say, one's location, one's nation, one's city, one's place on earth. I am an Englishman. I am an Israeli. And we know how strong those identities can be and how passionately people will fight to preserve them. We can also see this identity with place as a strong attachment to our social identity, our role, who we are in the world, a teacher, a parent, a philosopher, a politician, a train driver. And we can become quite caught up in nourishing and feeding this sense of identity because it gives us a sense of worth, a sense of position in the society where we can then, as it were, know our place, as we say. We know who to look up to, who to look down upon, who are our equals, who are not. And in any social situation, almost instinctively, we walk into the room and that calculation kicks in. Where am I amongst all this lot? That's what's scary about a silent retreat. You don't know your place. It's somehow not clear where you stand in relation to the others. But also, of course, as we go deeper down into our layers of ego identity, our beliefs, our religious beliefs. I am a Buddhist, I am a Hindu, I am a Muslim, I am a Jew, whatever. And again, I'm not suggesting that these things are somehow bad in themselves. They're not. They're unavoidable. We cannot not be of a particular place, of a nation. We cannot not be of a certain role in a society. We cannot not have certain views. We cannot not have certain beliefs. Even if we say, I don't have any beliefs whatsoever, I reject all conceptions, I reject all identities, I'm completely free, there you've just gone and created another position. It's unavoidable. The problem is not in the position or the place or the identity, but it's in the extent that we cling and grasp and hold on to that as though it is our only security. It's what we will struggle in a deep sense to uphold and preserve. The Buddha describes this also in terms of what he calls home, the household, the house. And he speaks of his renunciation as a going forth from the home to homelessness. And this is not just a description of something he actually did when he left Sakya, but at a deeper level, it's something that we do all the time, or we can do all the time. We can leave our homes, we can become monks and nuns, and then, quite quickly, in many cases, the monastery becomes our home, the place to which we identify and attach. Or our religious beliefs, our views. And all of these things are problematic because they somehow freeze us into place. And also, they very often set up a kind of opposition with those who don't hold our views or don't belong to our nation or don't believe in our politics. So it's not a question of just rejecting all that, but rather learning to live with it in another way, in a way that recognizes that all of these identities are contingent, are conditional. They arise out of circumstance. They can be related to more lightly, more fluidly. And it's here that the Buddha speaks of conditioned arising, this ground, this foundation, which is the basic recognition of how nothing is stable, nothing is fixed. Everything is in process, in flux, it's moving, it's in flow. And that is, in a way, his way of speaking about life itself. But he says, those who are attached to their place, for them it is very hard to see this ground, to see the flow of life itself, the rising and the passing away, one thing giving rise to another, and so on and so forth. One of his most succinct definitions of this contingent arising or conditioned arising is where he says, let be the past, Udayan, the person he's speaking to, let be the future. I shall teach you the Dhamma. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. So the Buddha's awakening is an awakening to the radical contingency of the world, of the person, of the mind, of mental states. He recognizes that to live fully means somehow to relax and release that grasping, that craving on these fixed positions and identities and beliefs, and open ourselves, heart and mind, to the flow of life itself. But of course, that is still all really rather abstract. The Buddha is not concerned with simply recognizing some general principle of causality, which in some ways might be what this sounds like. That in itself is not enormously transformative. It is his starting point. We might say that it is his E equals MC squared. It's his core kind of axiom on the basis of which everything else that he teaches unravels and develops. Having had that insight, which, according to the text, was a radical shift in his whole being, it certainly wasn't just coming to some new intellectual perspective. And this, I think, has to be repeated again and again. We're talking here not of theory, or we're not talking of theory alone, but we're talking of praxis. We're talking of actual movements and transitions within our body, within our mind, within our heart. And this is what, in a way, characterizes the Buddha's awakening as radical. It is a profound existential, an almost seismic shift in his very being. And it leaves him in a state of shock. It leaves him in a state of not knowing actually what to do next. And then there's this period where he remains in Uruvela, what is now called Bodhgaya, for several weeks, not knowing what to do. And eventually, his experience begins to coalesce into a strategy of action. In the text, this is described as the appearance of Brahma, God, who tells him, there are people with little dust on their eyes. They'll understand what you're on about. And it's at that point that he then decides to actually begin to try and communicate what he's experienced. And he heads off to Varanasi, Banaras, and there he teaches his first discourse to five former friends of his, or five friends of his who were formerly practicing asceticism with him. I'm not going to go through the whole text, but I want to focus on the next statement the Buddha makes about the nature of his awakening. Because once we get to the first sermon, the principle of conditioned arising has been teased out. It's been developed further into an actual practice which becomes a way of life, a way of actually living in this world from moment to moment, a path. And as we saw yesterday, Mara is precisely what deflects us from the path. Mara is what shuts us down. Mara is about what makes us hold on and attach ourselves to these fixed points and identities and so forth. So it's entirely, I think, appropriate that the Buddha translates his principle of contingency, conditioned arising, conditionality, however we translate it, into a process of living. And I'll just read out the passage towards the end of the sermon when he describes in very clear terms what it was that made him awake. And he says, as long as my knowledge and vision was not entirely clear about the 12 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, I did not claim to have had a peerless awakening in this world with its humans and celestials, its gods and devils, its ascetics and priests. Only when my knowledge and vision was clear in all these ways did I claim to have had such awakening. This, I feel, is, and I think almost has to be, as a Buddhist, one starting point for understanding awakening. It's an awakening about the 12 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. And the Buddha repeats this in many, many passages. Particularly if you look at a series of texts called the Saccha Saṅyutta, the connected discourses on the truths, we find him saying things like, whoever in the past, the present, or the future becomes fully awakened to things does so by becoming fully awakened to the Four Noble Truths. Now, before we get into the Four Truths and the 12 Aspects, let's just pause for a moment and compare that to how we might conceive of this awakening or enlightenment. What is striking is the Buddha doesn't say that he has awoken to the truth. In fact, it's quite striking that he immediately speaks of four truths, not one truth, and certainly not one truth with a capital T. Nowhere does he use any word that stands for some kind of ultimate reality, some kind of absolute, like the unconditioned, or emptiness, or the true nature of mind. None of those ways of thinking or speaking are there at all. And remember that this is being taught in a culture that holds a very clear idea of what the ultimate truth of the world and reality is, namely Brahman, which we might loosely translate as God, or Atman, which is identical essentially with Brahman, the true self, which is often thought of as a kind of pure consciousness. Those ideas were already there. And here we have the Buddha saying that he has woken up, not to the truth, but to four truths. And not only to four truths, but four truths in 12 aspects. I find it quite consistent in the Buddha's teaching that he resists the temptation to single out a kind of privileged religious object, something that stands above all other phenomena, something which is deeper, more transcendent, more real, more true, and that's what we wake up to. Something behind or beyond the so-called veil of appearances, some kind of noumenal reality. The Buddha wakes up to his being in and of this phenomenal world. Phenomenal, phenomenon in Greek means that which appears, that which shines forth. The Buddha's experience of awakening is an awakening to the phenomenal world. And as we saw also the other day, when he talks of the nature of this phenomenal world, he talks of it as these, in terms of these five interconnected clusters: materiality, feelings, perceptions, inclinations, consciousnesses, all brilliantly interwoven one with the other in a kind of ongoing, seamless flow of events. The Buddha's awakening is to this open field of contingent events in which mind is not in any way superior or more ontologically real than matter, and matter is not more ontologically real than mind. It's not a materialism, it's not an idealism. It is, in a way, a kind of precursor of what we would call a kind of phenomenological experience. But again, it's not just an understanding of that principle, it is a waking up to a way of being in this world in a specific way. And this process, this way of life, has to do with these four noble truths. Now, these four noble truths, as I'm sure most of you are aware, the first truth is that of a dukkha, or suffering. The second truth has to do with craving, or grasping. The third truth has to do with stopping, cessation, nibbana. And the fourth truth is the Eightfold Noble Path. So the Buddha's awakening concerns suffering, craving, the stopping of craving. That's how he defines the third truth, the stopping of craving, freedom and independence from it, and the fourth truth, the path. In other words, an actual way of life that engages every aspect of who you are, from how you see the world, think about it, speak, act, work, apply yourself with effort, practice mindfulness, and practice concentration. Again, every point within each truth again elaborates into yet further detail. So rather than his awakening being a kind of reduction of plurality into some kind of unity or oneness, which is so often how we think of a mystical experience, it's actually going the other way. At every step, there's more diversity, complexity, plurality, differentiation. The 12 aspects of the four truths, now what are they? The answer to that is found in the immediately preceding passage, where the Buddha says, such is suffering. It can be fully known. It has been fully known. Such is craving. It can be let go of. It has been let go of. Such is cessation or stopping. It can be experienced. The Pali word literally means something like, you can see it with your own eyes. You can experience it directly. This stopping of craving. It can be experienced. It has been experienced. And such is the path. It can be cultivated. Or very literally, it can be brought into being. It can be created, cultivated, developed, and it has been cultivated. So here we have these four truths, suffering, craving, cessation, the path, but each one is presented as a task that can be first recognized, second performed, and third accomplished. Now, if we are mathematicians, 4 times 3 equals 12. So the 12 aspects of the four truths are in fact the way, or sort of shorthand, for the Buddha's describing his awakening as the recognition of a set of tasks, the performance of a set of tasks or actions, and the accomplishment of a set of actions. Now, we're a long way here from some mystical revelation of the unborn. We're into a total engagement with all of our being with these primary facts of life. This is the awakening. And again, I'm not making this up. This is in the first sermon. You may not be familiar with it. I would recommend very highly that you study it. Okay, so what does this mean in practice? What does it mean to fully know suffering? To fully know suffering, the word I think we have to emphasize here is pari, fully, totally, completely know suffering. I think this is what we're doing in the practice of mindfulness. I think this is essentially what where all Buddhist practice begins. Perhaps it continues and deepens continuously. The willingness to open our hearts, open our minds, open our senses to the reality of dukkha. Now, dukkha, although I've translated it here as suffering, and I think in most translations you'll find something similar, is nonetheless a little misleading. Because the Buddha does not see suffering purely in terms of pain. He says birth is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha. Now, in some respect, yes, we can see how there are elements of pain in all of that. He also says, and this is in the same text, he says, in brief, this psychophysical existence is painful. In other words, these five clusters are painful. Feeling, perception. But wait a minute. Feeling, doesn't that include pleasure? Yes, it does. Or, if we look at another passage from the Satya Samyutta, the Buddha says, I do not say that the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths is accompanied by suffering and displeasure. It is accompanied by happiness and joy. So this is not, as is sometimes thought, a recipe for being more miserable. There's a paradox here. In opening to suffering, we are not, as it were, making ourselves more unhappy. Paradoxically, it opens us to another relationship with our human condition, with our birth, our sickness, our aging, our death, and the totality of what we described the other day, from materiality to consciousness. I don't think in that broader sense we're meaning only pain, but rather the fact that experience is conditional, it is constantly on the move, one thing giving rise to the next, giving rise to the next, giving rise to the next. It's not a place where we can find any fixed place, any organization of the elements of the world and our mind that can guarantee us happiness. We do our best, and we spend a lot of time trying to manipulate the conditions of our life such that we achieve a set of circumstances which we think will give us lasting well-being. You might have seen yourself doing this. That much of our fantasy in meditation, if you pay attention to what it is that interrupts your attempt to fully know this condition through mindfulness, much of the fantasy has to do with trying to get something or get rid of something. In other words, to try to organize the elements of your life such that you get the perfect situation. Perfect job, perfect house, perfect partner, perfect car, perfect laptop computer, perfect this, perfect that. We may intellectually know that that's a bit silly. We might have lived long enough to know that that's perhaps not something we can ever totally achieve. But the power of habit is very deep. And in spite of ourselves, we are seduced and lured and drawn towards things, new things that are presented to us as desirable, that are associated with the good life. You know, look how they advertise instant coffee on the television. They don't just put a jar of the stuff on a blank screen. Buy me. No, they put the jar of coffee on a little table, very nice lace tablecloth, very nice little bone china cups. Impossibly handsome man and impossibly beautiful woman are sitting at this table. Beautiful little child is dancing around on the green lawn. Big golden retriever, freshly washed, comes bounding along. And you kind of think, well, if I drank this crappy instant coffee, hey, that's what I'd get. You know, one laughs, but then the next time you go to the supermarket, I think I'll have that one. So this, so dukkha refers to this, beginning to recognize and to notice that any condition in the world is ultimately unreliable. You can't depend upon it for what you most deeply yearn for, which is well-being, contentment, a sense of being okay in the world, being able to be at ease in the midst of conflicts. That's what I think many of us, and probably all of us in a way, are seeking. And yet we look for it in the wrong places. We look for it in the manipulation of the circumstances of the world. We look for it in trying to sort out our own inner psychic mess. We look for it in having the most coherent and correct set of beliefs. But none of these things, since they're conditional, that they're constantly changing, and of course, since we are constantly changing too, there's nothing stable in this world. To hope for that kind of well-being is an unachievable goal. Well, even if we get the most perfect things, we are subject to losing them through death, through illness, through lawsuits, through war, whatever it might be. So fully knowing dukkha is not just knowing that I've got a terribly bad pain in my knee right now, although that's part of it, but rather recognizing this kind of fundamental unreliability of the world itself, the transient, shifting, conditional nature of things. To really know that, and to really know that, means not just to register it intellectually, but to begin to feel it and sense it in our bones. And that, I feel, is what the practice of meditation is about. Slowing down, finding within us a kind of ease, a stillness, an openness, a clarity, what are technically called shamatha vipassana, stillness and insight. So we can begin not just to know things differently or from a new light, but really to feel them in the same way as we did that meditation on death. We all know that we're going to die. That's not any great revelation. But we don't really know it. And if we did, if we felt it in our bones, if it became part of our intuitive sense of being in the world, that would change a great deal. That would change our whole perspective on life. We'd live each moment perhaps with a greater depth, with a greater valuing of the sheer mystery of the unfolding of experience, rather than constantly hankering for something that we don't yet have, like wealth or enlightenment. This fully knowing suffering, this fully knowing dukkha, is profoundly important in terms of the unfolding of this way of life. And as we open ourselves to suffering, here I'm using it in the more usual sense, we also begin to realize that suffering is not just my suffering or my pain, but as we begin to reflect and to open our heart particularly, and again, the meditation on loving kindness, compassion, all of these are meditations about opening ourselves emotionally, we begin to realize that tragedy and suffering and injustice and pain are there right throughout the world, through all human and animal communities and societies, that the path does not culminate in love and compassion, it starts there. This fully knowing dukkha is also the first step in the beginning of empathy. Empathy being the capacity to feel in the other person's body, to be able to feel their pain. And in this way, we start to break down some of the borders of our fixed identity, which think of we are obviously concerned about my suffering and the suffering of everybody within the orbit of what I call mine, my children, my friends, my relatives, my fellow supporters of the local football team. But beyond that border, we're able to feel complete indifference to the suffering of others with whom we do not feel that empathetic identity. In the breaking down of the structure of ego, we are also opening ourselves to the world, to the pain and the suffering of all beings, as the Buddhist texts say. And in this sense, the fully knowing of dukkha is the great leveler. There are no borders in suffering. There are no boundaries. There are no divisions. There is no man and woman in suffering. There is no human and animal. There is no gay person and straight person. There is no Jew and Arab. There is no right wing and left wing. All beings suffer. And the practice of fully knowing that is the very foundation of what then follows. The letting go of craving, the experiencing of stopping, and the creation of a path. The Buddha presented these truths in a sequence. One being the condition that gives rise to the next, and the next one being the condition that gives rise to the one that follows. So fully knowing dukkha is the condition for letting go of craving. Letting go of craving is the condition for the stopping of craving. And the stopping of craving is the condition for the creation and the cultivation of a way of life. So in what sense then does fully knowing dukkha give rise to the letting go of craving? In my understanding, it has to do with the fact that in fully knowing dukkha, we radically alter our primary perspective on life, on what life is about. When we come to feel, for example, rather than just know, that we and others will die, we and others will suffer sickness, aging, death, that the possibility of loss, of failure, of breakdown, is present in all circumstances for all beings. When we come to witness our life from that perspective, then we undermine the whole rationale for getting this, getting rid of that, achieving this particular manipulation of conditions, setting things up so we think we'll then get happy with the things that we associate with well-being. In other words, this endless and rather ultimately futile striving to organize the world according to what I want, that ceases to make much sense the more that our primary relationship to life is founded in this openness and this awareness of suffering. We begin to reorient our values, what begins to matter for us, what seems really to be the challenge of living a deeply human life, that when that begins to take place, when your sense of what really matters has less and less to do with material gain, or fame or any of these things. You begin to relate to others and yourselves and the world from another point of view. And so in this sense, this grasping, this craving, begins of its own accord to simply not mean so much anymore. It might still happen, it'll probably keep on happening. After all, these habits die hard. They're going to be around for a while, probably for the rest of our lives to some degree. But the less that we identify with them, the less that we buy into their story, the less that we are caught up in their scheming, the less power they will have over us. Our lives will become less and less driven by these obsessions and infatuations and fears and hatreds. They may even, at a certain point, begin to fade away altogether. There may be moments in our lives where they're not really operative anymore, or they occur less and less. Or when they do occur, we can say, like the Buddha says to Mara, I know you, you're that habit of mind, I've seen you before. You're that old craving, grasping, that kind of stuff. You know it, and you really know it. And so even if these things arise, these desires for this and these fears of that and these hatreds of that, they don't really have the capacity any longer to overwhelm you. They're just the play of the conditions of your neurobiological system. You can look at them with a certain lightness of touch, a kind of ironic regard. Hey ho, here we go. Off on that little trip again, without getting caught up in it. And it's in that sense that letting go of craving, which is brought about by this fully opening or embracing dukkha, naturally, organically, leads to moments, more moments, moments which last longer and longer, in which we find ourselves responding to the world from an awareness that is not conditioned by greed and hatred and egoism. And that's what the unconditioned means. That's what Nibbana is. Nibbana is the stopping of greed, of hatred and delusion. It's the fading away of these things. But the Buddha is realistic enough to know that just because you may have had a very deep experience of an awareness that really is not driven by these things at all, that is just an openness, an honesty, an immediate encounter with life, and even if these little habits still flicker in the background, they no longer have the capacity or the power to drive your reactions, to drive what you say and think and do. And as you practice more, as you become more attuned to this way of life, these things in themselves diminish. They become less of a problem. They become less of a force in our lives. And it's that that opens up the possibility of another way of living in this world. And that brings us into what is called the Eightfold Path. Now, technically, in Buddhist terminology, this experience or this moment of stopping, of the stopping of craving, this is known as the time you enter the stream. Stream entry, sotapatti. And the Buddha was once talking to his disciple Sariputta, this guy who crops up a lot, and he said, the stream, what now is this stream, Sariputta? And Sariputta says, This is how these discourses talk. And Sariputta says, the stream is the Noble Eightfold Path. Entering the stream is entering the Eightfold Path. I mean, really entering it. And you start with what is called Samaditti, usually translated as right view, which sounds a bit dogmatic and slightly moralistic. I'd prefer something like appropriate vision or true vision. And when the Buddha is asked what that true vision is, he says it is the true vision of the Four Noble Truths. So we're beginning to realize that we're not talking about a linear process where deluded, ignorant, stupid me somehow follows a path and ends up as this omniscient Buddha. But rather, we're talking about a process that is constantly ongoing. And not only that, it's somehow holomorphic. In other words, you get to that one little point, the true vision of the Eightfold Path, and what that turns out to be is your experience of the Four Truths themselves. The fully knowing dukkha, the letting go of craving, the experiencing the stopping, and the creating of the path. And the first moment of that path is a new vision of the Four Truths, fully, and so on. So we enter into something that is not, you know, some great truth, some ultimate reality, but we open into this ever-deepening, ever-more complex and refined experience of our relationship to life itself. And again, I mean, we have another passage from the Sacca Sanyutta, the collected discourses on the truths, and the Buddha says each of these four truths has, quote, innumerable nuances, innumerable details, innumerable implications, countless nuances, shades of meaning. The more that we look into these things, the more that we apply ourselves to them, we realize they don't reduce us to a single fact, but rather we become more attuned to the subtlety of their textures, their feel, their variations, their details, as he says, their implications. There are countless implications, countless details, countless nuances. And so once again, we find this practice is leading us not to some single great reality or truth, but rather it is continuously opening up the world in its diversity, in its complexity, in its richness. And it's all, and I feel it's probably infinite. There's an infinity in this. It's, of course, a bit like that famous passage by William Blake, to see eternity in an hour, to see a universe in a grain of sand. And later Mahayana Buddhist texts pick up on this idea. And they talk of the interpenetration of all phenomena. Rather an abstract idea, but I think the germ of this is already here in this idea of the Four Truths, the Eightfold Path. And of course this path leads also to the practice of mindfulness. And as we saw, when the Buddha describes the practice of mindfulness, or recollection and awareness, that too culminates in recollection of the Four Truths. The Four Truths keep reappearing. The Four Truths are so utterly central to what the Buddha is teaching, but not only teaching, but also encouraging us to perform, to act upon. They are tasks. They're not propositions to believe or disbelieve. They're things to do. This constant emphasis on praxis, on doing something, not just holding some view, some belief, some doctrine. Actually engaging with life in a radically new way in which we both know things more fully, we begin to experience this dropping away, this falling away of our instinctual, habitual assumptions, beliefs, behaviors, motives. We begin to discover within ourselves an open, uncluttered space, not driven or determined by fear and desire, which allows the opening of a path. And again, if you reflect upon the metaphor of the path, a path is essentially an opening. A path is essentially a gap. You know, we think of a path, the paths that run through the kibbutz, for example, we think of them as concrete things laid on the ground. But really what a path is a space in which there is no obstruction. It's an unimpeded track where the impediments to free movement have been removed. Big slabs of concrete are very good at doing that. In the old world, in the countryside, a path is simply sustained and created through the constant tread of feet. And if you don't use it for a year or two, it vanishes. And I think that's a more appropriate way of thinking about this path. And that would have been the path in the Buddha's time. No six-lane highways. Little trails through the countryside and the forest. And the path is only kept in existence by people and animals walking along it. So the treading of the path, the treading of this Eightfold Path, is both following the example of others who have gone before us, and it's also keeping the path open for those who will come after us. The very act of treading a path is an act of gratitude and an act of responsibility. We create a path, as the Buddha said. The path is brought into being by our actions. And I'm going to stop on that point and tomorrow look further into the nature of this path and particularly its actual relevance in the kind of world we live today. Thank you.